Hello, everyone, and welcome to Qualitative Conversations, a podcast series hosted by the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group of the American Educational Research Association. I'm Jennifer Wolgemuth, the current chair of the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group Outstanding Dissertation Award Committee. I am excited to be joined today by Dr. Maureen Flint, who is the recipient of the 2020 Outstanding Dissertation Award for her dissertation titled Methodological Orientations, College Student Navigations of Race and Place in Higher Education. Dr. Flint is an assistant professor of qualitative research at the University of Georgia, where she teaches courses on qualitative research design, analysis, and theory in the College of Education. Her research agenda focuses on the theory, practice, and pedagogy of qualitative inquiry. In particular, she's interested in artful methodologies, as well as questions of social justice, ethics, and equity in higher education. Maureen's research has been published in Qualitative Inquiry, Cultural Studies Critical Methodologies, The Review of Higher Education, Journal of College Student Development, and Art/Research International, and many other outlets. Her current work is interested in audio, visual, and multimodal approaches to inquiry and representation. And some of her explorations in this area can be found on her website at www.maureenflint.com. That's www.maureenflint.com. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Flint. I'm really thrilled to learn more about you and your work.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I think it would be helpful for our audience just to learn a little bit more about your dissertation work. So can you talk about your dissertation? What was the scope? What was its methodological focus?
Yeah, absolutely. So my dissertation explored the socio-historical context of race on campus, and particularly through new materialist and critical spatial, feminist critical spatial lens. So to back up a little bit, I have a background in student affairs, and then I also have a background in the arts. And so both of those things really came kind of to the fore when I started my dissertation, as I'd worked as an administrator. And it kind of started from this question or this gap between what I saw between I was doing as an administrator and then the things that we said that we valued and the things that actually happened. And so I was really interested in kind of getting at that gap, particularly around the question of belongingness, and ended up finding theory as kind of this entry point to really work that tension. So a focus on place and the way that place and the histories of place mattered in students' belongingness. I started with kind of traditional methods of interviews and focus groups, and then kind of found they weren't necessarily getting at the complexity of place that I kind of felt on the day-to-day, or that my students kind of were alluding to in their interviews. And so I started thinking about what, kind of throughout my dissertation, there's this question of faithfulness to theory is the way that I talk about it, and how am I continually orienting to theory in the ways in which I'm designing and writing and representing, engaging with my participants, and thinking about kind of engaging with the space of campus and my research questions as a whole. So throughout my dissertation, I kind of move in and out of these various methods and analytic approaches, things like walking interviews and I had students make maps that visually represented the place of campus and then kind of walk me through them. And then when I moved into analytics, I started to think with sound as a way to kind of explore this layeredness of place. And then that kind of question of faithfulness also came out in the ways in which I wrote through my dissertation, is kind of continually pausing and stopping and thinking about, how is theory guiding me in this moment, or have I fallen away from theory? And so I think, that really became the guiding thread throughout it all. And it kind of closes with this kind of question of ethics and theory and faithfulness and the way that all those things intertwine, particularly in relationships with participants and kind of questions of futurity and kind of who are we as methodologists in this future to come. So, yeah.
Wow, thank you. It sounds like one of the things that I really heard you say, and I think would be really of interest to the listeners, is you started out with what we might call traditional or conventional qualitative inquiry, and then it was a combination of engaging theory, new materialist theory, and other sorts of theories that opened up different kinds of methodological possibilities for you. So can you give some advice to doctoral students who might be on that particular path right now as we speak?
Yeah, absolutely. I teach one of the classes that I teach is our design course. And one of the things that I have the students in that class do, we have kind of this traditional three interview project that's traditionally the outcome of that course. And one of the things that I do in that class is have students do one of those interviews as a non-traditional, scare quotes, non-traditional interview, and open the door for them to do something different with, engage differently with the site of their interview, their research questions, this idea of the interview itself. And I think that I see that for them really opening the door to think about how other things matter beyond just like an interview script and sitting across from someone and asking them a series of questions, how, you know, things like objects or changing the place of the interview or even going beyond. I've had students really challenge what an interview is and like engage interview documents or kind of go into an different types of analysis, but always guided by the theories and their literature and the research questions that are guiding them. So I think that that is an entry point there, thinking about advice to other students. And yeah, I think in my own work, it was also reading interdisciplinarily. So I was reading a lot in critical geography studies. I was reading in like literary fiction, poetic authors like Claudia Rankine and Cydia Hartman, who write in a very like literary poetic style, speculative fiction like N.K. Jemisin. And so those all really inspired some of the methodological choices that I made in terms of like thinking differently or thinking otherwise about representation or methodology.
Cool. you mentioned new materialism and new materialist theory and philosophy. So in addition to all this interdisciplinary reading that you're doing and this sort of practicing with innovating methodologies, what recommendations might you have for new materialist readings for students?
Rosie Bradotti is my girl. So she was really what guided my dissertation. She has a new book out on post-human knowledges that I think really speaks to this present moment that we're in of precarity and exhaustion and capitalism and white supremacy and the ways that all those things are colliding all at once. Sarah Ahmed has been, although she's not necessarily a new materialist writer, she's really informed my work, particularly around thinking around feminism. And who else? Anna Singh's work has been really important. And I think she has a new website out that's beautiful, that's thinking in these really layered ways about the Anthropocene. And I guess maybe more broadly, the thing that I would say about reading is that I've really been inspired by reading with other people who are working in other spaces and places. And so I end up reading things that I never would have, coming out of my discipline in educational research, but also with this background in higher education, we become, especially in higher ed, become really siloed. Mm-hmm. And so thinking with people who are in math education or English or geography or other spaces has been really expanded my reading in productive ways.
Those are some really great sources and great suggestions. And I appreciate the injunction, right, to read widely and read across disciplines. It's impressive what it opened up for you in your dissertation.
Well, I guess maybe what I think I found reading really, I've always enjoyed reading a lot. And I think reading with people has been something that has been incredible. It's one of my favorite things about being an academic or getting to be an academic, of thinking with people. And so maybe I think finding people who you enjoy, who bring joy to your reading, is perhaps another thing. So, yeah.
That's great advice. Finding anyone who brings joy to anything is probably important.
Indeed, yeah.
So, in addition to everything that you've said, there are lots of graduate students right now who are writing dissertations. There are lots of faculty members who are writing books. Can you talk about your process of writing your dissertation? What was it like? What helped? What got in the way?
Oof, what got in the way? I guess where to start, Susan Cann and I actually just wrote a chapter for an edited book that you and Kelly Guyot have put together. And we actually were writing our dissertations together. We met at AERA through the QRSIG, which actually, to back up a little, was hugely helpful for me in a variety of ways in my academic trajectory as a grad student, from doing putting together proposals for AERA, getting to send it to a senior scholar in the field and getting feedback. I think I sent Candace Coopy like a 40-page manuscript, and she was like, "Oh no, you might need to cut this a little bit." But I just had no idea, right, of what to do. And so the QRSIG was really helpful in mentoring me along in how to become a member of the QUAL community. And so Susan and I had met at the mentoring session at AERA and ended up reconnecting at ICQI and then reading together over the summer. And then both were kind of separately told by our advisors to stop reading and start writing because we both wanted to graduate that spring. And so I think, you know, that was hugely helpful, having someone in a similar place to talk through, not just, and share writing, not just around like the literal parts of the dissertation, but all of that other stuff that goes along with it, like the excesses of like the hoops and the job market and the worry and the anxiety. And so we write about it in that chapter as like the swarming of like coming together of texts and other folks that we're writing with and our advisors and are writing as this kind of collaborative move. Even as we were writing separately, we were writing together. So finding that type of community. And I had a group of people, it was kind of a mix of faculty and other graduate students who we would write together really early in the mornings. We had kind of this set schedule of Tuesdays and Thursdays where we'd meet at Starbucks or McDonald's at like 7 in the morning or 6:30 in the morning. And for me, that was really helpful because it was a time when like there were no other distractions. There was someone else who's expecting me to be somewhere. There was some accountability. So that helped a lot. And then I think both with Susan and with the people I wrote with, starting to think about your dissertation is like chipping away at small pieces of it rather than thinking about it as a huge month-long endeavor. I remember staring at a stack. Actually, my committee let me put a picture of it in my dissertation, but I stared at a stack of printed out transcripts, I think, for like 3 weeks, just staring at them, not knowing what to do. So finding ways to chip away at it was helpful. And well, one of those things that I did, but that's how I like turned to sound, because I couldn't deal with the three-inch stack of paper. So I started taking audio clips and layering them together to think about it differently.
That's so interesting, because you noticed something that wasn't working for you, right? And it sounds like your dissertation emerged through that process. You had collected interviews to answer a question, and you found them wanting in one way, shape, or form. And then you went to analyze them, and you found that process that you were meant to do wanting. And so you chose something new. And that's something that comes out really loud and clear in your dissertation and in the rest of your work, is that you're not just a scholar, you're not just an analyst, you are a creator, you're an artist. So can you talk about what being an artist and producing art, I know I didn't send you this question in advance, so apologies for putting you on the spot, but it's so fascinating how that plays into your work and your identity as a scholar.
Yeah. Well, when I was growing up, I always wanted to be an artist. My mom was an art teacher. And I went to school to be, I'm trained as a pattern maker. So what that means is like the construction of garments. So like a designer draws a sketch and the pattern maker looks at it and tries to figure out how to make that real or possible. And that often means like being very creative or inventive in the fabrics that you use, or like the ways in which it gets seams are cut, or the ways in which it's put together. And so when I took my first qualitative research class, there's this kind of click that I was like, oh, like design is really, there's this parallelness between, art creation through this pattern making lens, and then design. It's like this puzzle that you're figuring out how stuff fits together. And there might be multiple ways for things to go together. Or maybe along the way, as you're trying to put stuff together, something else becomes possible that's way more exciting than your initial idea. And so I think that's always like an undercurrent of my work. And then there's other places or spaces where I've thought more explicitly with art making practices as, I think this happens in research design, but I also think it happens in art making, where there's this ethic of experimentation or process. Actually, I was in a talk with Anna Singh, I think last week or the week before, and she was talking about like this idea of the detour, or of contingencies and following those things. And I've always found in art making that those are things you should follow, that you should see what they make possible. And I also find that true.
The Qualitative Research Special Interest Group was established in 1987 to create a space within the American Educational Research Association for the discussion of ethical, philosophical, and methodological issues in qualitative research. We invite you to consider joining the Qualitative Research SIG today. For members of AERA, the annual fee for joining the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group for regular non-graduate student members is $10, and the annual fee for graduate students is $5. As members of the QRSIG, you will gain access to a network of fellow qualitative scholars, as well as our many activities, ranging from mentoring opportunities to our podcast series to updates and news related to recent qualitative publications and jobs. Please visit the American Educational Research Association's website at www.aera.net to join the Qualitative Research SIG today.
So can you talk about, so some scholars build off their dissertation work, and sometimes, like myself, they move in different directions for a period of time. So what are you engaging with, and what are you thinking now?
Yeah, I Well, one of the things that's been really exciting post-graduation or post-dissertation has been getting to explore, particularly in my dissertation, like some of the lines of thought or ideas that I get to like fully flesh out there. And so my writing right now has been doing some of that. For example, there's a footnote in my dissertation about a leaf blower, and like the way that it kept coming up in the audio of my dissertation, because I was doing these walking interviews where I was asking students to take me on a tour of campus, take me on an alternative tour of campus. And throughout it, there was like this buzz of the leaf blower. And in my dissertation, I had this little footnote that was like, this is really interesting the way it keeps coming up. Like listening to this as a more than human sound, like how, what might this do to think about the productions of place and how it matters. And so I wrote this paper that's in, I guess it's accepted with minor revisions. So it's not complete.
Yay.
It's still hanging out. Anyway, I like get to follow this leaf blower around and like unfold these practices of like lawn maintenance and the history of leaf blowers and the way that that's entangled with low paid or unpaid or historically enslaved labor, and how like listening to them and following that thread begins to like unravel this neutrality of place and the ways that, you know, white supremacy and capitalism are baked into the ongoing productions of higher education. So, and that's been really fun to follow some of those threads. So I guess I'm still writing with my dissertation in some ways like that. And I've also really enjoyed the opportunity to collaborate with people. That's been really inspiring and, joyful, I guess, to return to joy. Susan Cannon and I have kept writing together, reading together, and then we've been really thinking about feminist new materialist theories and in conjunction with like counting practices and metrics and how that produces academic subjects and how we might methodologically intervene in practices of counting. I've been writing a little bit with my friend Carlson Kugler at Alabama, and we've been thinking, she has a beautiful art practice around embroidery, we've been thinking about artful ways to engage with and respond to theory. So those are a few of the collaborations, but I think that's been super cool to get to really like lean into collaborative work and thinking post-graduation.
And the viewers can't see it, but you have this big smile on your face that clearly shows, the joy that collaborative work brings.
Yeah, I think like thinking with other people is such a creative process, because you end up in these like unexpected spaces and places because of like the multiplicity of your ideas. That's just so cool. And
can you talk about, speaking of joy, the ethical aims or ethical tensions in your work? Sort of from an axiological perspective, what do you hope that your work accomplishes or moves or shifts within the field of qualitative research or the other fields that you work in?
Yeah. It's interesting to me. I think that in a lot of ways, my work started off really interested in speaking to the field of higher education. Great Addy has this quote about seeking modes of representation and forms of accountability that are adequate to the complexities of the world we're living in. I may have mangled that a little bit, but I think that was really like an ethical move that I wanted as a person who came out of higher education. I have a master's degree in higher ed administration, that I really wanted, I saw you know, this intersection of theory and methodology, particularly new materialist and feminist new materialist theories, as this ethical move in higher education to think more complicatedly about the space of college campuses and the way this they produce and are produced by students and faculty, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I've been talking with one of, I read with my friends Laura Smithers and Paul Eaton, and we've been reading together over the summer following, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and the always kind of this resurgence of racial justice movements and this anger around the ongoing violence towards Black people and all of it in this moment in the election that's in a week. Like I think about writing and methodology as like a response to that, that is like, I think about it as, so we talked about, like I feel in some ways like I'm writing, like writing my way out of this moment in some ways, or my way through. And I think that's actually misquoting Hamilton. But like, I think about methodology as this ethical responsiveness to the moment that we're in, and particularly like as a white woman in this moment, like what, how do I respond and what's my place and how do I do this in an ethical way? Like I think about my research is needing to pick up and engage with all of that, be responsive to it. And I never quite know what that's going to look like in the moment, I guess. I think about a paper that a graduate student and I wrote over the summer that ended up in a totally different place than we expected. We had proposed it last fall, thinking with John Lewis's Good Trouble, and then we started writing it in May, and you know, writing about Good Trouble and John Lewis in May of 2020 is totally different than writing with it in September of 2019. And so we really, I think, struggled through that paper with how to respond to this moment in a complicated way is, and I think that's still ongoing. So, yeah.
So shifting gears a little bit back to advice giving for graduate students, a lot of doctoral students that I work with, and I know others in our community work with, are very interested in doing critical and post-informed and artistic sorts of work. And they come up against expectations for formats for what proposals look like. And so I'm just curious, from your experience and your perspective as an assistant professor now, what does a proposal look like, and how did you communicate what you wanted to do to your committee, and what were their sort of questions and concerns?
That's actually a question that I've had, I mean, particularly I'm teaching our analysis class right now that I've gotten from a lot of my students there as I'm sharing articles from qualitative inquiry and stuff that moves beyond traditional formats. And they always ask like, oh, like how did this get published? how are these people taken seriously? And one of the things is, well, this isn't necessarily responding to your question, but one of the things that we do in that is look at, like, we take all those like traditional things that are in a paper, and then I ask them to like think through this non-traditional paper and think about one, what's the purpose of it? What's it doing? And then, you know, sometimes they'll find that, oh, like all of these pieces are here. They're just presented in a way that's different because, and then we talk about like why that is, like how presenting in this non-traditional format is actually pushing you to think differently about, you know, what research could be or the purpose of it all. But going back to my dissertation, I was really lucky in that Kelly Guyett, who is my advisor, we talked about really early on the fact that I was probably going to do something that moved beyond the traditional five chapter format. And she actually really pushed me to do that. So I remember sitting down with her after my proposal, which actually looked fairly traditional in that it had an introduction, a statement, like statement of the problem. This is what the literature is. This is what I plan to do. This is why. Here's my theory. And she really pushed me to move beyond that and think otherwise. She pushed me to think about what my represent, like how is the way that you're representing your dissertation aligned with your theory? Like you keep talking about this in your methodological section. So how like your representation should also think about that. So, as I finished my dissertation, we had continually talked about like a more than representation, like an artful installation or something. And so that was something I did a pop-up art installation before my dissertation defense itself, where I invited my participants and people in student affairs and community members. And the room where my dissertation, where I defended, I had created these like fabric panels with quotes from participants. It was like sheer fabric with their quotes on it and some like big pieces of theory, weaving them all together. And then the sounded compilations that I'd made were playing in different parts of the room. So as you walked around, you heard different voices and different stories being told about place. And so that was really neat. I mean, I think I was fortunate that she really pushed me to think that. So I think, and I also, you know, I had, I think 26 chapters in my final dissertation. And the graduate school didn't blink an eye about that. Like it's interwoven with images and pictures. I have like these layered maps that show up in between chapters. And so long as it had 1-inch margins and like APA formatting was right, they were pretty cool with it. So I think that really taught me, and that's been my experience submitting to journals too, is that one, that so long as you're fitting in, you follow some of these rules, there's some space there, and like creating like hypertext spaces where your work can be otherwise, like that pop-up installation, or I had links throughout that linked to my web. That's why I created a website. And talking with your advisor about what you plan to do along the way and finding folks. I mean, I had a 5-person committee that was really, really supportive of me. And we talked about that all along the way of how stuff might look different than they were used to. So,
all of that.
Yeah, I think it's hard advice to give because you know, I also didn't know. I did, so some of the stuff that ended up in my dissertation was actually stuff that I've experimented with in classes, or I experimented with, I guess it was my prospectus that was fairly traditional, and then my proposal started to move beyond that, and I started to play with that. So I almost like showed them like, these are some things that this might look like, but here's ways that I'm thinking about experimentation. And so we got to have these really cool conversations about theory, and what that could mean for or how that might inform representation or inform, or if, I mean, we also talked about like, should I be representing anything anyway, because I was using non-representational theories. But, you know, we got to have these really cool questions about theory and the way that that might inform my work in multiple ways. So, yeah.
So I'm hearing, if I were to summarize your main points.
Yes, please do.
Advice. I'm hearing that having mentors and committee members mm-hmm. who are supportive is really important. I hear that having examples of other people who have done this kind of work, whether it's in journals or your dissertation, for example, is important. I hear that even though we think journals and grad schools are very rigid in their requirements, they actually may be a lot less rigid than we think they are. And I hear that being open to thinking about alternative ways to engage your dissertation, like the hyperlinks that you were talking about, are all ways in which we can open up the idea of what a good proposal and a good dissertation looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for summarizing all that. I tend to ramble. One of the things you said reminded me, some of the best advice I got, especially when I was in my prospectus or proposal stage, was Kelly Guyatt told me to go and look at ICQI's experimental dissertations who had won over the past several years, and that QR SIG who had won, and the arts-based research SIG. And that was really helpful for me. I remember reading David Bright's dissertation where he really plays with footnotes, and it's beautiful, and like this like kind of happening in my brain where it just was like, oh, like you can really play with the format of this in neat ways. So that's some more concrete advice, perhaps.
You're the best. Because you're so good at giving concrete advice, and because you're in a fabulous position at the University of Georgia, so you're now an assistant professor at the University of Georgia, just in case fabulous didn't communicate. So can you talk about your experience being on the academic job market, and do you have any tips for those who are starting to get that right now or soon?
Oof. Yes. I was trying to think. I think the way, as someone who is now working in the field as a new professor, I've been asked to be on like all these panels of like how do you get an academic job, and I never. Even though I can, like, I think there are multiple levels of tips. Like, there's, like, the logistical, like, when should you, like, having conversations with, having lots of people look at your CV and give you advice on it was really helpful to me. Talking really early in your academic career with your advisor about, like, what you want to do. Like, I remember my first or second year talking with Kelly about, that I wanted to, actually at the time I was still on the fence between the administrator and going the academic route, but that changed after I had a middle manager job as an administrator and realized not the world I wanted to live in. But anyway, we sat down and like recognized that one gap area that I had was I didn't have a lot of experience teaching. She and I co-taught a class with her, and then also ended up reaching out to a faculty member in the higher ed program to co-teach a class in student affairs, because when I went on the market, I was actually doing a double search of methodology positions and higher ed positions. So having experience teaching in both of those was helpful. So, I mean, there's like that logistical advice. And I think, I mean, some of the best advice that I got was about not taking it personally, that the job market is like this weird mess of a space where sometimes people don't really know what they want until they start getting applications. And so a job posting could be perfect for you. And then, you know, actually they're looking for something that was never on the posting itself or was too in excess to ever be on a posting. And yeah, I think one thing that really helped me when I went up for position or when I was applying for positions was really thinking about why that job made sense for me or why I was excited about it. And really thinking about doing a lot of research on who was there and what, like the exciting possibilities of collaboration at spaces and kind of what I was bringing to the table to really be able to speak to that in my interviews, to talk about like, these are the things that I'm interested in. And here are some areas of overlap. And like, this is what I can, this is why I'm exciting or should be exciting to you. This is why I'm excited. So yeah, I think, and really thinking about, I think the last thing that I'll say is really thinking about kind of who I wanted to be as a scholar. And like, I ended up kind of thinking about it as like telling the story of reading together these three interests in like questions of social justice and equity in higher ed, methodology, like theory and methodology, and then art, full practice, which actually often blends into methodology. But like all of my work picks up threads there. And I think that also kind of helped me be able to point to like, these are some things I'll be interested in the future or might be interested in, or some lines I could follow, which, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how important that story is. Telling, being able to tell the story of who you are as a scholar. And it's also amazing how that story needs to shift in different kinds of ways in order to, you know, apply to different positions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like that story that I told, I think that's the story that I remember best now, because I applied for a lot more and heard back from a lot more qual-focused positions than I did higher ed positions. But the way I positioned myself for those was very different. Very different in the way that I really highlighted my experience as a practitioner and administrator, and really highlighted less the methodological focus of my dissertation and more its focus on a higher ed context.
So. Well, the qualitative research community is glad we got you.
I'm really glad to be here.
I speak for the whole community, just saying. So I'd love to end just by hearing from you about where people can access your ongoing work. If they want to reach out to you and have some conversations, how might they do that?
Well, I have my website, which I believe you provided at the beginning of the podcast, so maureenflint.com. And I host a lot of visual representations. My audio compilations are there, and then that's kind of an ongoing project of playing with how to tell my story in a digital format. And then email at maureen.flint@uga.edu. I'm always happy to chat with folks. So yeah. And I run our UGA Qual program Facebook page. So you should follow us there, because we like to highlight our student. We have both our PhD program and the IQS certificate, or Interdisciplinary Qualitative Studies certificate. And so we highlight a lot of the student work that comes out of there as well.
That's great. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Dr. Flynn.
Yes, I've truly enjoyed this start to a Wednesday morning. Thank you.
The Qualitative Research SIG of the American Educational Research Association invites nominations for the 2021 Outstanding Dissertation Award. Eligible dissertations should exemplify excellence in qualitative methodology and may typify the SIG's mission to legitimize all non-traditional forms of research and emphasize ways that qualitative research may contribute to reducing inequality and injustice in schools and society. Dissertations defended during the spring, summer, or fall 2020 semesters, but no later than Friday, December 4th, 2020, will be eligible for consideration. The committee chair must receive nominations by Monday, December 7th, 2020. If you have questions, please feel free to reach out to the chair of the committee, Dr. Jennifer Wolgemuth, at jrwolgemuth@usf.edu.